Hi, this is John. We have a special podcast today. I will be doing a phone interview with Paul Champagne, the noted sword smith, bladesmith, sword researcher, who is one of our Armor senior consultants and a really great guy with just a fascinating insight into the manufacture of historical blades. And we're going to be giving him a call in just a second and doing an extra long podcast.
Okay. I have on the phone today Paul Champagne, who is a, well, I'll let him describe it in his own way. Paul, if you would, tell our Armor listeners what it is you do and what it is you consider yourself.
Well, that's a good question. I guess I consider myself a researcher on ancient edged weapons, construction, materials. I don't consider myself, so to speak, a knife maker or a sword maker. I mean, I don't do this on a production basis. I chose not to. But I guess I'm more of a guy that should be working in a museum, but I like to work with my hands too much. I really like to get down and make the steel, collect the ore, forge things out. So, a hands-on researcher, I guess.
So would you, you wouldn't call yourself, or would you, a blade master or bladesmith or swordsmith?
Well, I make swords, spears, axes. I focus on them as weapons of war, so I'd be more of a weaponsmith, I guess.
Yeah, weaponsmith, yeah. I believe there is a German term for weaponsmith.
I'm sure there is.
I think I sent it to you once. I think it's something like Waffen... I'll find it again. But it's kind of cool. So, do you consider then the hands-on aspect of your craft that involves, you know, the artistry of bladesmithing to be just one aspect of what it is you do as a researcher into a historical bladed weaponry?
Yeah, the nice thing about it is that there's so many different facets. So I could just go to museums and study, you know, length, width, balance points, construction techniques. But beyond that, it's like, okay, what was the steel like? How were things heat treated? What was the metallurgy of the older pieces? And then another step beyond that is, okay, well, how do I duplicate that so I can actually see what these blades could have actually done? And
right.
Modern steels don't really come close to the same qualities. I ended up having to try to make my own. Snowballed.
Well, let's talk about that in particular, because there's a lot of information, misinformation out there about modern steels and how they compare to the historical steels. And I know you've said to me before that, heck, modern steels are made using modern science, so they're vastly superior, but this does not mean that a modern reproduction sword is itself superior to a historical one.
That's exactly right. I mean, the modern steels, gee, I'd love to be able to say, wow, making it the old way gave you something magical. And just from a performance standpoint, not necessarily.
Oh, what, you mean it doesn't? Not magical?
I mean, a lot of it has to do with the smith. So not all steels are equal. Not all techniques to use those steels are equal. How do I say that better?
Right.
I guess if you handed an old Viking smith some modern 5160, or he was using what he was used to using, he may be a great smith with his materials. He may mess up using a modern steel.
5160
being... 5160 is a really common spring steel. It was developed so that would be tough and springy using leaf springs. Also makes great swords. Same thing with 6150. All these numbers are a way, it's a modern grading system, so to speak, and each number in its place tells you how much carbon's in there, what type of other things are thrown in the mix to make it perform a certain way.
Well, what I see is two issues that are interrelated. One is, people like us, we want to know about the real historical swords, how they were made, what their construction was like, and how that made them good weapons. And on the other hand, we want to know how to evaluate modern reproductions to know whether it is historically accurate, or whether is it, and therefore is it or not a good training tool. And
yeah, which is really important.
If for each side of that
looks
coin,
like an old blade, but doesn't perform like an old blade.
I'm sorry. Could you say that again?
If you're using something that might look like a historical blade, but doesn't have certain performance qualities,
right,
plus or minus, then how do you know you're actually able to use an old blade if you were, say, back in time using those
Yeah, that's what I mean. For each side of the coin of these two aspects, there's so much information that's just contradictory or false, and it leaves people very confused, I think.
Well, here's some really broad ways to look at it. Whenever you do that, it just kind of opens the door for trouble, but that doesn't really bother me. The older, say, more traditional steels, either made by each individual smith or shop, back before modern smelting techniques, they were pretty much dependent upon the ore that was there. They didn't go out of their way to mix in extra stuff to a formula, so it would quench better in oil or have certain properties at a certain hardness. Right. It was made, and they could tell, okay, this is going to harden more than the other one. They knew their materials from growing up with them and being taught, but basically they were just a shallow hardening, simpler, you know, carbon and iron and a few other things that might have been in the ore. So what that basically means is that you're not going to get a real leaf spring out of that stuff. Oh, sure, you can make it springy, you can make it really hard, but it wasn't designed for that. You tend to have a sword that would tend to bend before it broke.
Right.
Especially made the way in the construction techniques that most of the blades, say 1400 and earlier, were made in different cultures. And you find the same thing around the world. I guess another thing I should say about what I like to do, I don't just stay in one culture or technique. I'm fairly well versed in Japanese, and doing a lot of research in the Chinese stuff right now too.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of similarities with European all around.
Right. Well, then that brings us to different types of swords were designed to achieve different results and against different types of opponents and armors and weapons. And that would mean that the manufacturing process would be slightly different, say for a single-edged curved blade as opposed to a tapered, straight, thrusting sword.
Yeah, making the steel, similar, having to refine it and then usually, you know, fold it because there were some crucible steels and some other parts later on. But the folding, refining of different steels, stacking them up to make a big enough billet, which is just one big chunk of steel to make the blade out of, doing certain things to the core, twisting it, putting in iron. So there's a lot of similarities. The cultures were doing a lot of similar things. And though the swords may have looked different, what they were working with, steel-wise, construction methods, weren't as different as you'd really think.
Mm-hmm.
Just say with a Japanese blade, you don't see twisted core stuff. Japanese got their techniques from the Chinese, and in Chinese, you do see twisted core, which you'd also see in, say, a Viking blade.
And tell us something about folding, since so often you hear statements like European swords weren't folded, or you hear something like Japanese swords were folded so many times that makes them superior.
Really, the folding process is just, it's a way to refine the material. Every time you fold something, stretch it out, you're not just folding it, you're stretching it back, and you're getting it to a very high heat. So when you squish it back together, it all becomes one piece of steel again. And in that forging and squishing together process, a lot of stuff flies out. Meaning you lose half your material, what you're starting with. It refines it, a lot of the little pebbles, the junk will come out, fresh from a smelt, the first few folds, you've got little pieces of charcoal and stuff that can be in it. And nobody came out with these big chunks of just perfect steel until much later on in the process. So almost everybody had to fold and refine something. If you didn't fold and refine it for a blade, it would break. You would have too many dissimilar areas. You want to try to get it a little more similar, a little more homogeneous. You don't see that in all metalwork back then. Sometimes they just took a bloom and forged it out. You see that in some pieces of armor. You can see distinct pieces of the bloom in there where there's a really hard section and a soft section. Some blades that wouldn't fly.
How does this relate to pattern welding?
Pattern welding is when you, usually after the steel is refined, you can put them together and fold them into two or three, four, whatever, dissimilar steels, higher carbon, lower, usually from cultures from different blooms. And each one will give you a distinct layer, which you'll purposely try to bring out through the polishing or etching process. You're trying to show that pattern.
Right.
I guess that's one of those terms where the view is one way, but it can encompass so many different things. The Japanese sword, you wouldn't call it pattern welding, but they're folding it, and there's distinct patterns through different school, you know, in the blade.
Right.
They don't necessarily bring them out with acid like you do in modern stuff. But it depends where you want to draw the line. None of this, you know, the pattern welding itself doesn't necessarily make it a better blade. Again, it has a lot to do with the smith, the material used, not so much the pattern makes something good. Or the construction technique. You hear a lot about, you know, sanmai, things like that. Just because it's made from three layers doesn't mean it's necessarily a better sword.
Yeah. If you could, real quick, tell us something about your background, your education, so that how you got started making swords and researching them. What I mean by that is, how does innate talent at doing this correspond to developing the skill through trial and error, and how does that relate to, say, a modern education in science or metallurgy or cutlery or whatever type of engineering field?
Well, I guess I've done so many different things. I like so many different things. They all kind of come together with the blade. I've always been artistic, like to sketch. I've always liked to read. I like history. Education-wise, I've gone through everything, you know, computer science minor, marketing, business. Does that really help out with the sword stuff? Well, I mean, what it does is it lets me make a very good living during the day, which lets me not have to sell the blades to make a living, so I can do all the research I want.
Right, which means you don't have to BS about what you're selling.
Yeah. I've always had a keen interest in chemistry, metallurgy, the sciences, and both my parents were pretty well educated, and my father was a health physicist. So I was always around science, and it was always very important in the house. That really helped me, you know, get a grasp, kind of teach myself the metallurgy I needed. The hands-on stuff, I mean, I don't know if there was anything innate or built-in talent, because from my point of view, it's just been so much hard work. Lots of trial and error and breaking blades, breaking things, pain to have them analyzed, and how many times does it take to do a smelt while you're, you know, getting all different things at the beginning going, how can I get what I want? What happened here? The scientific process was, I guess, being brought up that way, is the biggest thing. And also the love of it makes me, you know, push through where you might want to give up because it's frustrating.
Yeah, the commitment level there.
Exactly.
So it's half opportunity, half commitment.
Oh, and there's so much random things, just meeting the right people sometimes.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because you can't do anything on your own. I'm pretty much a hermit, but it doesn't mean I haven't been influenced by people.
Yeah, I know the feeling.
Sometimes you find people that you see how they do something, even if you don't like the way they do it, it's like, I don't want to do that. That's still an influence.
Yes, yes,
because
absolutely.
You didn't have to do that your own way. It's like, oh, I see a problem with that. I don't want to do that.
Yeah.
My problem is I'll still try it that way to prove it anyway.
Yeah, you know, we do the exact same thing when it comes to wielding the weapons.
Yeah, it's test, no matter what it is. Even though I've been doing this for a long time, each blade, I don't just assume it came out of the quench a certain way. Every inch of that blade is tested with a file. Things are adjusted as they need to be adjusted. I think I know enough about the materials never just to turn your back on them. Like now, with a good product, you have to always be on your toes.
And are you, when you're making a piece, you do it as an experiment, you're basing it on an original, or are you doing sometimes just a metallurgical experiment?
I'll do both. I really like to stay, though I have, I don't know how many drawings, I guess you'd call them pseudo-historical pieces, fantasy pieces. Well, fantasy kind of out there, let's not call them that.
Right, let's call them experiments.
Yeah, but things that I wanted to combine, you know, maybe parts from different types of swords or different cultures. I'll do that for my own gratification and see how they work, and that worked great. But because it's not historical, I won't base a lot of hard testing that I'll go out and tell somebody, hey, I tried this, but I tested that. You know, I made this type of katana in this style, and I tested it. If I'm really trying to relate to the historical pieces, I really want to stay historical. But sometimes I'll just be testing materials. I do crucible smelts, too, and I'll be able to test that stuff. Harden it and bend it in a vise and compare to something else and lots of notes. So it's a combination of sometimes I'm just testing materials, sometimes I'm just testing for edge geometry.
Right.
Sometimes I'm making a reproduction of a blade in somebody's collection to see how it actually feels, how it works, how it moves.
Well, I think what makes you such an incredible resource for us is that your commitment, your energy, your integrity, and the fact that because you're not focused on commercially selling swords, you can be free to say, well, this is what I found out, and this is what they did back then, as opposed to someone who says, buy my swords, they're really good, yeah, man. Or, hey, man, do you want to buy a sword?
There's some really, boy, how does
yeah, sword... it's accurate, man, sure.
Yeah, but you got to be able to back that up.
Right.
And the sad thing is that, well, it's getting better and better. There's a lot more information out there now than there was 20 years ago, let's put it that way.
Well, I know our recent article that you helped me substantially with on how swords are really made. It was very popular, and we got a lot of good feedback on it.
Oh, good.
Which brings me to the question about, tell us something about how edge hardness historically relates to flexibility, whether the two are somewhat incompatible in a blade, and how the smiths managed to get those two qualities, edge hardness and yet flexibility in the cross section.
So many people's view of what a sword should be is out there from, either watching movies or hearing something about, modern knife making with modern materials, that, some people get hung up on this hardness measurement called Rockwell, the way to measure how hard the steel is. And you start looking at how old blades, how they're really made, and how hard they really were, kind of the culture. But you find a lot of, say, Viking, European, later, say up to 1300s or so, there's not a lot of information out there, but you look at a lot of pieces, you see a lot, and you realize these things weren't big springs. Because there's so many little bends in the old pieces, little sharp areas where you sight down an old blade in a collection, and you see where it's got all these little bends in it. That doesn't happen for springy type of sword.
Right.
So the older blades are, on average, were a lot softer than say people would think a modern blade would be.
Now, you said earlier, though, that spring steel makes a decent replica. So are you saying that they purposely went for swords that were not as springy?
Well, I mean, that's kind of the whole reason for doing the research. Where I sit right now, which may not be where I am, say, a year from now, 2 years, or whatever, wasn't where I was 10 years ago. But
I know the feeling, yeah.
But where I'm looking at some things now is, again, they knew they were able to make chisels, woodworking tools, things like that. And you analyze some of those edges, and they were very high carbon, very hard.
That's right. Yeah, you told me about that.
People knew how to do that.
Right.
You look at the swords, and they purposely stayed away from that. So they knew these materials. They knew how to put them in. And even though maybe, steel was a little more rare than iron, harder to make, but still, a sword, no matter who was making it, especially when it was made for somebody in the upper crust, was expensive. If somebody thought the best sword would be made by making it all from the same steel you'd make a chisel edge out of, they would have done it, but
right.
They didn't. And they erred on the side of soft and tough. The only way that really causes a problem, if you translate that into modern replicas, is, one guy put it really great, a friend who's got some Japanese blades, and I know the katanas would actually take a set, they would bend before breaking, but you know what, I don't want to pay thousands of dollars for a blade that I'm going to do a bad cut with and it's going to bend. So he, for cutting, he'd rather use a modern steel blade,
right,
hardened all the way through, tempered back with the edge left a little bit harder. So I mean, that's a good way to look at it. Like, yeah, I know here's how the old ones worked, but I'm only doing this twice a week, and I only have a limited budget. I'm not going into the battlefield, so I'm going to err on the side of something that's not going to need all this upkeep all the time. And the only place I see that might cause a problem is in some of the deflection moves, again, in a lot of different cultures, where you've got a blade that's not edge to edge across that dimension, but across the flat.
Right.
It's really waxed up and hard with a flat,
right,
and it's fairly thin, and it's not a spring like the modern reproductions are, it's going to bend on you a bit.
Right.
Is that bad? The way I look at it is, I mean, the world, the countries and kingdoms were made on these swords, the way they were made back then. Hundreds of thousands of people were killed by these things. People in armor, people out of armor. So they must have worked okay, even being the way they were. So
bending,
I tend to, again, try to be as historical as possible. But means you make them that way, they're going to bend first before they break.
Better to bend than break.
Won't be a big spring.
That reminds me, did you happen to see the Mythbusters program, Movie Myths, where they tested some swords?
Oh, I didn't do that.
You'll have to look that up. You probably you can probably download it. There's a thread on our forum about it, because they use several types of katana replicas against each other, edge on flat. Then they use the same blades against some very poor quality European replicas. They were, in the bottom line, it was good in that they showed what happens when two edges hit, that the edges are terribly damaged. And they showed that when you hit the flat, the blade will flex and bend. But the slow motion camera caught their machine striking the edges, and some of the blades they hit would bend in a big curve, and other ones would bend in an S bend and whip back. And some of them snapped, but they did not snap at the point of contact with the edge. They snapped down by the hilt. And I know that they contacted you about that program. Did you ever, what kind of information were you able to give them about that?
Honestly, I kind of just stayed away from it, because I realized that, there's just so much to that, and it's a fun show to watch. I've seen a few of them, I like it. But to do it correctly, they're not going to have the budget or the time to do it how I would want it to be done. What reproductions did they get, and what type of...
Who knows?
And then who qualified that? Based upon the old ones, did they contact anybody that actually knew something about?
They had some Kinjitsu people who came in, did some Tomishigiri, what was interesting is they clocked them doing vertical cuts on a block of ballistic gelatin. And I thought it was interesting that they didn't cut that deeply into the ballistic gelatin, yet he was supposedly cutting with a 13th century piece. And I would love, and the speed that he cut with wasn't that quick either. And they cut so differently than we do with a straight blade and with our different footwork and arm positions. I would love to have said, yeah, well, let me try with this bastard sword and see how deep I cut into that block of gelatin. So unfortunately, I didn't do that. I also found some problems with the mechanics of how they did the test. They had some type of lever arm that simply swung the blade in a big arc. Whereas a striking blade moves in more than just a big arc. And then the target sword was held rigidly still, more rigid and more still than any human would ever possibly hold a sword.
Yeah, I get the whole idea of that going edge to edge right there would be, okay, I think I'll change the channel.
Well, what they were trying to test was whether or not you could cut through a sword like in the movies.
But I
think they did a good job of as they say, busting that myth.
Yeah, well, that's good, too.
It was certainly nice to see documentation of a scientific experiment demonstrating what happens to edges when they clash. That was nice.
That is good, because they just aren't going to hold up that well.
Yeah. But it was funny, because I told them when they contacted me to try and find you, I told them, I go, look, none of the swords you hit are going to actually be cut through. They're going to be gouged, and then they're going to snap. And that's exactly what happened.
Yeah, but I guess, it's because we're around them all the time.
Yes.
And especially because I'm always breaking things. I'm kind of joke with me is I've broken more swords than most people have made. So I don't really know how to feel about that, but on purpose.
Yeah.
It's good to get the information out there. Kind of after a while, it seems like, well, yeah, of course. But then again, the average person just starting into swords, with the information, it's good to... Good that they think about what a blade is and what it's not. It's not this thing that's going to last forever, going to go through all these battles and not have any damage to it. It's going to be magical. It's going to be passed down for generations and used in all these battles. The sword has been passed down in history, but they're just going to take damage. These are going to be rehilted. They're going to be polished.
Perishable tools, as you've said before.
Right. I mean, I didn't start that way. I mean, when I was young, reading Tolkien, that's kind of what got me interested in actual making the sword. Like, how do you make a sword this good? I thought it's kind of an odd way to start, but that's how I started.
Well, I remember reading in the 70s Conan the Barbarian and Savage Sword of Conan,
And the black and white magazine Savage Sword of Conan was always more brutal and graphic, and the art was always better. And the one of the Barry Windsor Smith, famous artist, he and this other guy Sal Buscema, they always drew Conan with these incredibly thick blades. And I always assumed that swords had to be that thick. And you go to the flea markets, and there would be some of those old cheesy wall hangers from Toledo, and you'd pick them up, and they'd weigh like 8-9 pounds. And when you're like 15, that feels like it's 50 pounds. And I'm looking
like a lot now too, swinging it around.
Yeah, and I'm looking at how thick the swords are, and I'm going, wow, look how thick that is. And it took years for me to say, those morons, those absolute idiots, they got it completely wrong because they were going on what they saw in the Conan magazines and comics. Yep.
And then later on, when it was coming out with some early reproductions that were decent. Again, for production reasons, they had to make them out of, say, 3/16 all the way through.
Yeah.
You know, so you don't have any of the tapers, the balances are different. You know, but again, you know, how much time are you going to put into making something, you know, very historical versus how much somebody can actually, you know, afford to pay for it?
And then when they don't hold up to just moderate, use by a vigorous practitioner, the manufacturer says, oh, please, don't do that with my sword.
Yeah, they're up. I mean, the swords just take a massive amount of abuse. They go so fast. They're very difficult to make well and hold up to battlefield abuse.
Yeah.
Again,
and even just training.
Even the best sword can be broken by a bad hit.
Right.
So I've had some of my blades tested on some pretty tough stuff, but by some pretty qualified people also.
Yeah.
So.
Speaking of which, when are you going to make me a sword?
Well, you have to come up, and in fact, there's a blade I'm going to be doing once I get through some Chinese stuff, and then a Japanese Yari, and Lee Jones has got some pieces that I got a chance to spend a lot of time with. There's one on there I want to do a reproduction of, and when I do my first reproductions, I'll use modern steel. I'm not going to just to get the balance. Do I have the balance right?
Right.
Do I have the change? So when I get one of those, you may end up with one.
That
one of the blades
awesome.
Tilted differently. You know, an exact copy of one in each collection. That's not right. But,
it's been many years.
Blade-wise,
since,
well, look at that. You know. I'll have that hanging around, and I don't need any more things hanging around.
Well, it's been many years since I first handled one of your pieces and was so impressed by it.
Oh, thanks.
And so I'm really looking forward to seeing those and testing them. And I know other people are, too, just so we can say, hey, we know something now. About something more now about the real swords and how they were made and what they should stand up to.
It's always nice. There's always that 15% part of me wants to take the old materials. Even though right now I'm saying okay, yeah, the swords will bend first before they break, and I'm pretty confident about that. I haven't really seen full springy pieces, but I'm keeping my eyes open because again, there's just only so many examples out there and so many that I actually get a chance to handle and examine close enough to tell how they bent. Tell a lot from an old blade just by looking at its cross section and if it's still straight or not. But what I really like to do is take the old materials and then using information I have now from modern metallurgy, how can I max the performance out of the old materials? That's something I like to do too.
Exactly. Yes. Are you interested at all in reproducing some of the training swords that we know they used in the period? The Germans called them Federschwerter or Federschwerter.
Actually, all of it. Yeah, I mean, because it's not just if they trained with a certain weapon, that tells you a lot about what they were shooting for in the training.
Yes.
So, yeah.
Well, I've handled several makes of these things, never an original, and only one person, one make, has gotten it right, and it just astonished me how the things felt absolutely identical to a normal sharp fighting blade. It handled and performed and. Behaved exactly like you would expect, yet because it was thick on the edge and slightly narrower, you could really and more flexible, you could really whack somebody with it and not hurt them.
But you could still tell where the flats and the edge were.
Oh,
right?
Absolutely, and it did all the techniques you would want it to do, just superbly, as good as an ordinary sharp blade or a blunt.
That you say that too, because. Blade. If you look at a blade, tape, the tapers, the cross sections throughout the whole length of it, The way I look at that is clay. You know,
right.
Because I make my own steel, and you forge it, so you tend to do that after a while. So if you could have a clay sword on your table and just make it a little bit narrower, sticking up the edges, you're using the same amount of material.
Yes.
And it's balance points.
Right.
You know, at the same spot.
And that's the key. Yeah.
And that makes sense to make it a little thicker, but also narrower.
Yeah, that's the whole key to it.
Still tapered, because you're basically just pushing the clay up and keeping the mass at the same
right.
area.
So it has the same center of gravity, and it
yep.
handles the same way, and that's what it's all about.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, absolutely. And this company that made is making some, the way they got it right is by obviously copying originals, but curiously, it was all in the fuller. It was all in how you make the fuller, which allowed you to distribute the mass differently along the blade for this new shape, yet maintain the same handling qualities.
Well, the nice thing about that is because you start taking your fuller out a little bit, a little bit tip heavy, a little bit more toward the end, a little more here, a little more there. So it's just like trying to balance the lawnmower blade. When you're sharpening them, it's like, this side's going down a bit, I'll take a bit more off that side. So the fuller allows you to still keep your basic dimensions, but relieve mass.
Lastly, and I apologize for this noise, I have an 8-week kitten on my lap who will not stop.
No problem.
Lastly, we did some test cutting recently, and we used a variety of different species of bamboo, because different species of bamboo is harder than others.
Mm-hmm.
And we were fortunate to have a member who came in with a bunch of samples. His father is involved in some type of horticulture. And one of the pieces we had was about 6 or 7 inches in diameter. And we cut at it with a Grossmesser from one company, and it wasn't very impressive in the result of its cut. It cut about less than halfway through, and the blade sustained a little bit of damage and a little warping. And then I struck at it with a tapered, very tapered, straight, double-edged war sword, roughly a late 14th century, mid 15th century type blade. And this blade, even though I struck with the tapered end of it, it cut through as deeply without any damage at all to its blade. That was quite enlightening to see a tapered blade cut that severely, whereas a sharp single-edged blade, much wider, did not. And so I had to attribute part of it to the cutting experience of the swordsman, as well as to perhaps just a better quality make of weapon.
There's so much to cutting. Half of it is the guy cutting. How consistent are you and all that. The other half, I'll say a quarter of it again, is how good that blade is.
Right.
Good as in, is it going to hold together or come apart when you hit anything? So let's assume that it's a pretty durable blade. Once you get to that, you start to get to where you hit on the blade and the edge geometry, so to speak.
Yeah.
You can have a tapered blade that's really thick that may tend to pry that apart first, so you hit it, and then it just kind of cracks and splinters on the other side.
Yeah.
Well, there's also material, because cutting mats is one thing, cutting bamboo is something else, cutting sapling, they all have a different feel.
Yeah, and you mentioned it before when I was telling you about some impressive cutting I had done with a blunt sword, and you had said, make sure you do some soft material cutting.
Mm-hmm.
And you were emphasizing differences between cutting hard materials and soft materials, and the importance of that. And in some experiments I've been able to do with straight blades, cutting on soft cloth armor wrapped around a punching bag, no matter how sharp the blade was, I could not get any penetration through the armor until I cut at a particular angle that allowed the point of the weapon to, provided it was not an extremely acute point on a very tapered blade, but cutting on such an angle that allowed the point to actually finish off the cut, and that's what actually would penetrate, is the point when it got to a certain angle. But hitting it with the edge never managed to ever penetrate the armor, although it certainly would have really bruised the guy underneath.
Yeah, and I think that's a really important point. Armor, even a little bit, can really mess up a cut, whether it's wool or padded cotton. I know you've done some of these tests too. In fact, I'm going to a museum Monday just to examine some different ancient armors of padded Well, I'll give you a report when I get back.
Hey, yeah, if you're doing, anytime anybody goes to an armor, we always tell them, take digital pictures of the swords and pieces and send them to us.
Yeah, so this is going to be actually all Chinese armor.
Oh, well, never mind.
Well, actually the techniques for, things aren't that different.
Yes, I know, but, you know, if you're...
It's not exact.
Yeah, I know, but if you're you know, studying Italian cuisine, you don't really care about somebody saying, hey, I went to a Chinese restaurant last night.
Wow. But see, I look at it, I'm studying swords and metallurgy, so
right.
It's all interesting to me, but I understand where you're coming from. But if, say you're not even working on mail, you're just working on padded, you're not gonna cut that stuff, especially when somebody's trying to move away from you, hit you at the same time.
Yeah.
But what you are gonna do, like you said, is tissue and bone damage just from the impact.
Yeah.
And that's why I think, I remember when I was working with Obata Toshishiro when I was doing the katana work, and even though this is European, but still, this is interesting. He translated it from an old work where they talked about the 100 cuts into sand. Like, what the heck is that?
They cut into sand.
They would, they're test cutting these blades because his whole focus was basically being like an old time, test cutter. Very precise, very powerful, very repeatable. I'm like, well, what does that mean? Well, they would test these blades and be very sharp on all these materials, cadavers, etc. But when they went into battle, 100 cuts in the sand. I'm like, oh, that makes sense. They kind of rounded, strengthened the edge, so they're not going to get these big chips out of this, overly hard edge, or even just harder than European edge on a Japanese blade.
If I'm following you, you're saying that prior to going into battle, he has a source that says they took their swords and cut into sand with them to make the edges, to round them off a bit?
Basically, it would round them off. It's not gonna be like put them against a belt grinder.
Yeah.
It'd be like taking a sharpening stone down the edge and stacing the edge.
Right.
It's still an edge, but it's not this hair-popping edge anymore.
Yeah.
Which will also make it, for my test, quite a bit more durable against hard armor.
Right. Yeah.
Now, did everybody do that? Did every school do that? No. I'm not saying that. I'm just saying there was a source for this. It was very interesting.
Well, I'll tell you about a phenomenon that happened to some swords I have. And you know how, just like you, I like to, when I'm talking about this, to avoid naming names of companies and makes, because that tends to distract people from the content of the experiment and all that. Because, you know me, I don't shy away from being critical of companies that suck. But otherwise, when we're talking like this, it's not important really to go into who made what. But
right, especially if people are trying to get better all the time.
Yes, exactly. It's only the people that are bullshitting our community are the ones that we're going
to
say, hey, bullshitter.
Yeah, there's no one for that.
Well, we had a very good quality tapered two-hand sword, and we were testing it against a bastard sword of my blunt bastard sword, which is held up phenomenally in test cutting. And it has a very thick riser on it, and it's a very wide blade. And we struck the tapered blade on the flat with the edge of the wide blade. And the tapered blade had nothing but a little scratch. And not even that, just a blemish. Whereas the edge of the wider blade, even though it has a very thick riser and is tapered itself somewhat, the edge on it actually distorted a little bit. And I don't mean like the very fine end of the edge. I mean, a quarter inch down from the edge, the blade actually warped slightly. And we thought, wow, that was interesting. And then when we did the opposite, we struck the edge of the flat of the wide blade with the edge of the tapered sword. The tapered sword showed no marks. We couldn't even find where on the tapered sword we struck. But the wider blade had a significant gouge in the riser of the flat side. And I just I found that very fascinating, because the tapered blade later bent on targets which the wider blade cut through easily. So I had a blade that cut better but was softer, as you were saying.
Which can happen. I mean, there's so much, because you're talking about two different geometries, possibly two different steels.
Yes.
You treat it two different ways.
Yes, very different geometries.
Yep, but probably the steels were probably different, unless they're made in a production by the same. But even then, batch to batch, blade to blade, things can be different.
And then the tapered blade later on bent on thrusting we believe it was on thrusting, but it may have been on cutting. But the blunt blade, the wider, thicker one, has not ever bent in any way, shape, or form because it's got a different cross section. It's going to be very hard for it to bend.
It could also be springier.
It's extraordinary the differences in differences between the steel, these two blades that are very different in geometry.
And that's another important point too. If people want to, or they tend to, what was this sword like? How was this made? How did this perform? Well, let's just say there was one period in one part of Europe, and these swords being made by different shops, different smiths, different guilds from two different countries, whatever it is, even two swords following the same pattern will be different from smith to smith, from the master to his top student to his third level student. Even though they may look the same and be made in the same shop, a different smith can impart totally different qualities, even very similar steels.
Right, right.
And I think that's so important because there's, how did old swords perform? Sure, that's really what I'm really after. But there's going to be a very huge spectrum from this sort of blade made kind of lousy. He's going to do this, okay? And
yes. So
that's why I do shoot for that mash performance in the old materials to see with the real geometries and the best performance I can give that steel, but still following how they did it back then.
Right.
What can you expect? But even today, people making, say, katana or making hand and a half blades, as you know, they can be all over the place.
Yes.
Really nice stuff out there, some people that really pay attention. And then there's some pretty stuff out there that I wouldn't want to go into battle with. Then there's some just, plain wrong stuff out there.
Yeah, I was testing some pieces recently, and they were adequate. And the maker said to me, well, thanks, we're going to try and improve them. And I said, okay, but you do know I haven't done with a historical blade the things I've done with your replicas. So I don't know whether the real blades would have performed better or worse than yours. So when you say you're going to try and improve them, you might be improving them beyond the capacities of the real thing.
And with modern heat treating, modern steels, and a knowledge of modern metallurgy, we should be able to do that. But the only way we get in trouble is does it affect the techniques?
Yes.
Are we going to be, hitting a lot harder with the flat and some deflection moves? The old swords wouldn't, they're going to bend after doing that? That's the only place you really get in trouble is, would the sword be able to hold up to the techniques that we're referring today or interpreting, so to speak?
Well, we're running long here, but I want to keep you on for one last question.
Oh, that's fine.
Because I really appreciate you being here with it. It's been it's always fascinating. And you're up there in upstate New York? That's where your shop is?
Yeah, I got 9 acres here, surrounded by 1,200 acres of woods, and on a road that not that many people on. There's only 12 families.
Very nice.
So yeah, it's pretty hard to get a hold of, no matter how you try to get a hold of me.
So when it comes to rapiers, as you know, that we cannot find a single rapier on the market, a replica rapier that is even close to accuracy of the real thing. And the single issue that stands out is not geometry or weight or hardness. It is flexibility. The manufacturers of replica rapiers, I'm talking a blade with a point on it, absolutely refuse to make these things stiff. And every real rapier I've ever handled has been incredibly stiff, absolutely just completely rigid. And I've even tried to give a few of them a flex when people weren't looking, and even whacked a few of them on different materials on their edges and flats to see how flexible they were. And they are extremely rigid. But not one maker, even the makers that I've consulted with and said, don't make these things, wobbly, they say, yeah, and they end up still producing something that is little more than a steel noodle, as one of our members called them, steel noodles. I just don't understand it. And you have told me before that it is no great difficulty whatsoever to make a thin blade rigid.
But to make it tough and rigid it can be difficult, especially with the modern steel that people want to use, especially in this litigious society. You want to make sure that thing's not going to snap. So making it a bit more rigid, keeping the cross-section harder all the way through, is if you did that with a modern sword, a modern steel, you would it could not be so tough. It might just crack all the way through.
Okay, well, define the word tough as you're using it here.
Tough meaning that it can take abuse, bend before breaking. If it does start to break, it may not break all the way through on the first shot. It doesn't mean springy. It
right.
Does not mean springy. In fact, tough necessarily. Really, you can think of it more as it's going to bend before it breaks. And that is one of the differences between a really simple steel and some of the modern stuff, especially the water quenchable. I mean, oil quenchable stuff. Is that it's going to harden all the way through to the core. It's going to be about as hard on the edge as it is dead center.
Hmm.
Which, if you're trying to make a reliable spring, is great.
No.
It becomes very strong. You put them in a bicycle back and forth, and do all that cool stuff that swords really aren't meant to do.
So you're saying...
People like to test them for that.
You're talking about a thrusting blade, a rapier.
It could be anything.
It needs
talking to... just metal in general.
Okay. Well, I'm a little confused there because you said it needs to be uniform in its hardness from outside to inside, but I thought...
No, I said a modern steel that these makers you're talking to. I don't know too many people are making...
Oh, I see.
...steels that match the old...
Right.
...the old steel. So that can be part of it.
Whereas a blade needs to generally be softer inside, harder on the outside.
Well, some of the... a simpler steel will do that without you even trying.
Uh-huh.
They won't... modern steels have all this little stuff thrown in the mix that we were talking about in the very beginning. In the recipe to help them usually harden evenly. So they're not harder on the outside like a hard skin and a little softer on the inside. And they make it so that you can quench them in oil, which is a nice gentle quench. They get nice and hard all the way through evenly, no matter how thick the cross section is.
Yeah.
And now you can temper them back and you make these nice springs that, like I said, you can put in vices and bring all over the place, slap against each other, and it's going to be a very... very springy blade.
Well, I wouldn't even hazard a guess as to whether a rapier is softer inside than it is on the outside.
I would assume certain things based upon steel technology of the day, but I'm not going to say anything definite until I actually make some and got a chance to analyze them.
Yeah, and in this case, I'm talking about the true rapier, your post-1580, very slender hexagonal or star-shaped or octagonal blades with deep fullers or high risers.
To look into that more. I mean, we've always talked about that, and that's one area where I really haven't spent time on that.
Yeah.
I tend to be, say, 1350 and before.
Right. Well, as I said, unless the blade is completely stiff, when you do techniques, the point goes all over the place, and you cannot do the actual rapier techniques. You end up having to do very sloppy modern épée techniques with a rapier, and that's not the historical method.
Well, that would be fun to work on. My ears and eyes open for sometimes the collecting circle old blades.
Well, you said to me once that it was not a challenge for a bladesmith to make a slender thrusting sword because it didn't have the challenge of the edge geometry that you all enjoy doing.
Well, I never said, I mean, everything's a challenge, right? Everything I do has always been multiple testing. I think making a thrusting sword, because it doesn't absorb anywhere near as much impact, is generally easier. It's like making a spear. It's easier than making a hand-and-a-half sword.
Okay. Well, I know I've sent you material before where a quote where a man in the early 17th century says, your rapier, there cannot be too much stiffness in a good rapier blade. And then I've sent you quotes where a man says, we test our thrusting swords by whacking them on water with the flat.
Which is a good test, by the way. It's been done in other cultures.
And then we hit them on an iron anvil with the edge, tap, tap. Then we flex them against a stone or brick wall, and it should make a big bend and then return true. And then he says, we run our finger or a cloth up and down it to see if it has any burrs. And then we look for discoloration. And he says it should be able to do all this without the point bending in the least. So he's saying, I want a blade that keeps a sharp point so it'll go through a sternum or a skull, but can withstand being knocked aside, beat on.
Which makes sense. That's how they were used.
But is rigid enough that when he parries, it's going to parry without whipping around.
Mm-hmm.
And that seems like that would be challenged to do, especially if he's talking about a blade with a hexagonal cross section or star cross section or octagonal cross section with a deep.
Right, I never said it wouldn't be a challenge. Like I said, everything I've done has always been a challenge when it comes to blades.
Well, if you can't do it.
Impacts are edge impacts with thin edges and having the whole thing hold together is pretty tough to do.
Well, I would love to see you try rapier sometime.
Actually, with the right information, because I like to work off of originals and real information, as you know.
Yes.
I know you're gathering all stuff up. I'm sure we're going to do it.
Well, I tell you, and we've had this conversation before, I go to a collection in some country or somewhere, and I bring with me digital calipers. You even gave me a pair taken with me once, and I left it. And I'm so excited about picking the pieces up and just wielding them and holistically getting a feel for them and trying out moves with them that the last thing on my mind is actual measurements.
I know.
So that 45 minutes later, the curator will say, oh, time to close, or up, oh, time to go to lunch, or whatever, or time to go back to the seminar. And I'm like, what? That was just 5 minutes just now. And they go, no, actually, it was over an hour. And I'm like trying to absorb, you know, memory information about each piece I've handled. So that, and I'm trying to get lots of pictures to document them. So that, again, measurements always slip through the cracks.
Yeah, one of these times when you get there, you go back to the same place. Start getting the measurements down there, and I'll do some blades for you. Get somebody to, you know, put the hilt on. We'll make them go in an existing hilt that you think is historically accurate, because it's really not a...
Yeah. I've requested measurements on several occasions from individuals, and it has never... It just always falls through, unfortunately, or they don't take enough measurements for it to be significant. According to Peter Johnson, Swedish swordsmith who works for Albion, he says he takes between 40 and 60 measurements for every blade he makes.
Oh yeah, you can get just basic measurements, minimum every 2 inches plus thickness. But you've also got to watch where things change. It's like, oh, there's a transition going on here.
Yeah.
Take more. Not to mention all the hilt, tang, the thing about
right.
where you can take it apart,
right.
it's already apart, or oh yeah.
And he says that's the key. Yeah.
It's very, and then you know, start talking fuller blades, how wide, how deep, is it uniform width between all the way down. So nope. Same thing. I've got all these little scrolls, I call them, because I get these drop-offs from the printer. Just roll out three, 4 feet of paper, cut it off. And when I go somewhere, I bring it, I trace the blade, measure it, take pictures.
Hmm.
I've got a nice collection of these little scrolls with all different blades and measurements on them.
Wonderful.
Over 20 years.
Yeah. All right. Well, I appreciate you taking out the time to do this with us.
Oh, it's fun.
It was fun. We'll have to do this again in a few months.
If anybody's got any questions, anything I said or whatever, just, you know, write them down and then give me a call again.
Sure will.
Be happy to, always happy to talk to you.
Okay, Paul, thanks for joining us. Bye-bye.